We are the Tri-State Sports Guys coming to you live from beautiful Norwalk, Connecticut. Neil Lynch will be joining us from our Hoboken studio. I think that's kind of going to be the norm going forward. I don't think we need to actually be in the same room together to break things down. I do miss Tony D not being by my side, because now I'm manning the boards and hosting the show. It's a lot to ask of old Mike, though. I don't know how well this is going to go. I don't even know if I've got the mic on, to be honest with you. But we've got a great show for you. Obviously, a lot to get to today. We had a great show last week with Tony and Neil both out of the country. We had Kevin Ireland from O'Neill's Irish Pub come in and join us, and it was actually one of the most successful shows we've ever had. I don't know if he's just got a little following. I know all the girls in Norwalk love going down and getting a drink from Cowboy. So he was great. We hit a couple things right on the head. I told you I liked the Spurs to win that last series and then kind of roll their way to the finals now. And now they're up 2-0 after a great game in overtime last night. We talked about the Knicks. We thought they were dead. And we knew the Rangers would have some problems going forward. And I think we hit the nail on the head with all of them. But we got to start out, and I'm sure Neil will be joining me shortly, but we got to start out with what we talked at length about last week and what our top 10 was based on, top 10 guys on the verge of becoming busts. And the conversation started with the one first baseman there over in Flushing, Queens, and Ike Davis, just mired in an insane – he got worse from last week. He was horrible last week when we talked about him. And since then, he's one for now, I think, 34, maybe more than that. I know he walked a couple times today, struck out, misplayed a ball in the field. I mean, these guys aren't even giving you good defense anymore. And, you know, we talked about guys being on the cusp of being busts. I'm willing to just write the guy off. I wrote an article last night, or went up online last night, about things that the Mets can do to become just competitive. Not even being competition to win the division, just to be like a team that other teams don't look past on their schedule. And I'm a realistic Met fan, so I'm not going to say, oh, we're going to open our wallets and we're going to get Ellsbury and Chu and outbid everybody for Robinson Cano and all that. That's not going to happen. So I tried to think of some things. I mean, they do got some money coming off the books. Obviously, with Johan, there's a small buyout there. I still don't know the exact figures of what they're going to be paying Jason Bay next year, but obviously it's a lot. It's very reduced from what they were paying him, so they got some money coming off the books there. So they're going to have some money to spend, but I don't see them going out and adding $50 million to their payroll. So the suggestions I had started with getting Justin Morneau, and I know a lot of people weren't huge fans of Justin Morneau, but they think this guy's old and, you know, he had the concussion and never really came back, this and that. But I think a guy like Justin Morneau, 32 years old, still hitting over 300, he's in a park similar to what Citi Field is, where it's hard to hit home runs, so his home run production is down, but I think he could be an impactful player, but it all goes back to the fact that Ike Davis is done. He's not a first baseman in the future. And now we got Neil on board with us. Neil, how are you doing over there, buddy?
You should just call me technical difficulties, because it's just been nonstop trying to get stuff to work, and then it doesn't work. But I'm here, and I'm dialing in, and I'm ready to talk some sports.
Well, before we get into sports, how's Blackout coming along? What kind of progress is taking place with the Blackout show?
We went international with the show last week. I managed to chug a whole glass of dessert wine, which is not apropos. It's inappropriate. Not supposed to do that, especially in front of coworkers. I forgot to mention that this week-long trip to Paris was a work trip, a business trip, to visit company headquarters in Paris, France. So, a lot of pretty big-time mistakes that will probably come back to haunt me, hitting on coworkers, chugging dessert wine, that kind of thing. But, you know, it could pay off in the end with a nice international episode of Blackout.
Well, here's what I like about everything you're just saying. I mean, chances are you're not long for this job. You're probably going to get fired in the next week or so. And, you know, people tend to really, when their back is against the wall, is when they know they got nothing else and you're down to your last few pennies in your pocket, Neil, that's when you're going to write a great pilot script. I mean, I've given you the skeleton. I've given you the bones of what you need to do, but you got to fill in the meat with what you do best. You know what I mean, Neil? And I think that a good, embarrassing firing in front of everyone is going to really be what pushes this show over the top.
Yeah, and that could be what, you know, launches me into this into the next level of blackout. I'm trying to think of a word for blackoutation, blackoutosity. I don't know. Can't think of it.
But yeah, a good port wine drunk is a whole different ball game, Neil. So I appreciate that. I mean, that'll go through your stomach for like 3 days.
Yeah, I just got regular.
I mean, that's cooking wine, brother.
This morning, yeah.
That is absolutely fantastic. Well, let's get to some sports. I don't know how much you caught. I started to talk about Ike Davis, but I'm just going to toss it over to you because Kevin and I last week went over Ike Davis and his struggles a little bit and talked about him being one of those guys on the verge of becoming a bust. I mean, do they need to send this guy down right now or what?
Absolutely. I honestly can't believe that they've waited this long, especially considering what happened last year. You know, they were winning a lot last year, and I think people didn't pay much mind to his struggles. And I think now that they're really in a bad position and they're losing a lot, that the focus is back on him tenfold because they need someone to step up other than David Wright and Daniel Murphy, who continues to be streaky at points. I know that he went 0-for-17 at one slide, and then he just went off and batted 500, but they're looking to Davis to be the guy that takes the pressure off David Wright, and that's not happening. So I don't think there should not be any hesitation here. You got to send him down. At the very least, shop him around. You know, and I know his value is at an all-time low right now, but you got to point to the second half of last year and say, this is the Ike Davis that you're going to get. He's the kind of guy that can give you 30 home runs, and for whatever reason, he can't do it in a Mets uniform. You've seen us give him chances. You've seen the bright spots, the highs, and you've definitely seen the lows. So, you know, what can we get for Ike Davis? I think this is I don't think it's too early to start making moves. You know, obviously, you know, some teams, they get off to a rough start, a slow start, and then they can just turn things around in the second half of the season. That's not this team. You know, I don't see them being like a powerhouse that just got off to a sluggish start. This is a AAA team at this point. You know, and I think it's time to shake things up. You know, Terry Collins is at wit's end, and I really do think that, you know, do you slide over Murphy to first, throw Valdespin at second, keep Tejada at short, and do it in the outfield, or do you throw Duda at first, his more natural position, I believe. Do you try and shop Murphy around, put Valdespin at second, Tejada at short, or do you say, Ruben, get your act together, we're going to put you on the bench, clear your cobwebs, maybe even send him down, put Valdespin at short, Murphy at second, Duda at first. I mean, something's got to change, and, you know, having Ike at first, is you've seen it. It's become a huge detriment for them.
Yeah, you know, the Mets, although they don't make many good decisions, a lot of times when you have a guy like Ike Davis, who showed some success early, you see it all across the league all the time, where even though they're not arbitration eligible yet, they'll give them that first little teaser contract of 5 years, $30 million. You know, like they did with Jonathan Meese. They extended him, even though they didn't need to, but they lock him up hoping that it'll be cheap towards the end of that contract when the guy's hitting his prime. And luckily, the Mets didn't do that with Ike Davis, probably because of the injury a couple years ago and the struggles he had last year, wound up saving some money. So, I mean, they could have a clean break. It's not like they need to try. I don't think that they're going to get much back from him. But, I mean, he's arbitration eligible next year, and he ain't going to make a lot of arbitration considering he's hitting 148 or whatever he's hitting. So they could – it is. I mean, they could – they really got to start to think. I mean, this guy's now 26 years old. This is fourth season in the majors. It's not like he's a rookie. And this is what you're going to get. I mean, at what point do you realize this is what you're going to get? I mean, a guy – you don't see many examples throughout baseball of a guy that's this lost for now two seasons, two starts of the season. Even last year, you can point to the 30 home runs. I mean, Mike Jacobs had a 30 home run season. Let's not kid ourselves. I mean, it was Pedro Alvarez. He made my top 10 list last week. He had 30 home runs. That guy's a bust, too. So they can break a break here. So the question is, send him down. Maybe he finds himself. But the question I think you allude to is, what are they going to do at first base? And I think you really have to look towards the future. If you think Lucas Duda can be a guy who's got an on-base percentage around 350 and can hit 25 home runs, and that's realistically what he could be, and first base is his most comfortable position, then I don't disagree with you. Let him play first base now and see if he can, you know, maybe it'll make him a better hitter, make him more confident and all that. I don't have a problem with David Murphy playing first base. Somebody posted, I don't know if you read the article I wrote last night about what I think they should do in the offseason, and I suggested Justin Morneau. And one of our listeners wrote on the wall, he says they should shift Murphy over to first and let Valison play second base for next year. And you know, he pointed out the fact that he doesn't have prototypical corner infield numbers, but you've seen teams succeed with a guy like a Daniel Murphy at first base before, whether it was Kevin Millar or JT Snow, or, you know, he's not Mark Grace, but a Mark Grace type guy, a guy that'll give you 10, 15 home runs, but can hit 300 and drive in runs and do all that. So I have no problem having David Murphy play first base. The problem is I think he's actually a much better second baseman than people give him credit for. And I think that's a harder position to fill. I'm not a huge – I mean, I like Valvestin for what he does. People just hate him so much in that clubhouse. And he's so night and day with his numbers between when he starts and when he comes off the bench. I don't know that he's the answer. I think it would be easier to go out and find a first baseman next year and just keep Murphy at second base than it would be to now ask Jordani Valvestin to actually live up to his potential.
Yeah, I agree to all those points. I mean, at this juncture, it feels like that Ike Davis has some kind of bribery deal worked out with the Mets where he has some kind of dirt or horrible secret that he's holding against them, and he says, you know, if you send me down, I'm going to reveal this to the world. It feels like that at this point because the way the Mets are treating this situation, they're acting like he's Albert Pujols or Josh Hamilton. He just needs to break out of this little funk that he has. And he's had decades worth of a great track record. I mean, it's really mind-boggling how they're handling this situation, considering. I have to go back to last year when they demoted Duda. It's like, really, if you're Lucas Duda, you got to be thinking, like, what did I do wrong here? You've been letting this guy slide for a whole half of a season. I have a 2 or 3 week bad span, and all of a sudden I'm down in AAA. People say, well, they don't think Duda's the answer because he's only had like a 220 batting average or whatever. But you made a great point. The guy has a 350, 360 on base percentage, so he's getting on base way more than a lot of the other guys in the lineup. So I have no qualms about moving him to first. And I also think moving him to first it puts him in a different mindset. It says to him, like, oh, he doesn't have to worry about a fly ball and tracking fly balls and almost hitting foul balls back in the fair territory with his glove, like trying to rob home runs. He just has to know, get to first base, you know, and catch the ball, you know. And I think that might take some pressure off him, and you might see results at the plate.
Yeah, you know, people kind of poo-poo the fact that, you know, these guys move around and go to new positions, and they act like guys are being selfish. And I'll even bring up the point when people talk about, like, eventually Derek Jeter's going to have to play the outfield. And basically he said he's a shortstop. He's not changing positions. And some people, the Jeter haters, say, well, that's him being selfish and not doing what's right for the team. People don't understand the difficulty in just changing positions from something you've done your entire life. I'm sure Lucas Duda played his entire life at first base. And just to go out and play the outfield at the major league level different ballparks, different dimensions, all that stuff that comes along with playing in the major league. And you think you can just, oh, yeah, we'll just put him out. I mean, look at like what Murphy did and how much he struggled out in the outfield. You're like, oh, that guy's not an athlete. It's not. You can't just wake up and make everybody an outfielder. And to put that kind of doubt in somebody's mind is going to impact them. So if he's comfortable, I mean, none of us have ever seen the guy play first base. It's not like we're going to say he's going to be – he probably is not a good first baseman either. But
right.
I feel like I agree with you. It will – positively impact his hitting because it's just one less thing to think about.
Yeah, and I mean, there's just a surplus of infielders, and someone's got to move. And they don't have I know they picked up Ankiel, which, I didn't get a chance to hear your take on picking up Ankiel, but anything's good at this point. And, you know, the experiment with Duda, you know, he either gets it or he doesn't. He didn't get it. and experiment with Valdez being, I can't really see him as a center fielder. It's something where you stick him out there and he kind of picks it up or he doesn't. And, you know, you can only stick with that for so long. So, you know, in my mind, we're only almost 2 months into the season, but if you're Terry Collins, and Terry Collins, you know, he's been known throughout his brief tenure for constantly tinkering and changing. So you're wondering why he's continuing, you know, is this now his response to us saying he tinkers too much, that he's going to stay with this horrible formula for the rest of the first half? I mean, he's at a loss, and I think he's just kind of fried at this point. And he's just like, I'm just going to ride this out, and, you know, I'll tell people if we didn't have the talent when I get fired.
Well, no, but that's an easy – I mean, we could debate the Ike Davis thing, what to do. What your point right there about Terry Collins, well, it's an easy thing. He stinks as a manager. He's a horrible major league manager. I've been screaming it from the top of the mountain for the last 2 years on this show. He stinks. I mean, name a guy that hasn't gotten worse under this guy. He's supposed to be the guy who develops young talent and all this. Everybody stinks. Everybody that's shown some glimmer of hope, whether it's New and Ice, whether it's Tejada, everyone regresses under this guy. So what is this? What does he do well? Jonathan Neese is worse. I mean, what? I mean, it's only a matter of time before he screws up Matt Harvey. He's horrible. He's got to go. And the idea of, like, that these guys give him a pass because he doesn't have any talent around, you know, doesn't have any talent to work with. You know, a lot of coaches don't have a lot of talent to work with, but you show something. You show that you're doing something. This guy's hanging his hat on, what, one half of a good season last year, followed by a monumental collapse, and then an atrocious start to the season where they were a joke and everybody's getting worse. I mean, why is this guy still there, man? Get rid of him now and just put Wally Backman up right now and see if you got anything in him. Like, I'm at the point where we have plenty of time left in the season. They have no shot of competing. This is the time when you got to start to see what else you got. And it starts with the manager. I mean, people talk about calling up Wheeler and all that, and I know he was injured and he hasn't been pitching well. I don't agree with just rushing him up just for the fact of giving them some spark. But eventually he's going to have to get some major league innings, I think, this year, because you want him to come into camp next year with a little taste of major league so he's ready. But I think you can definitely shake things up and see what you've got, because all the Met fans want to see Wally back. But you don't have to call him up and give him a 5-year contract. Pull him up, see what he could do, give him next year. If he stinks, then, you know, 2015, go find another manager.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the season's completely lost at this point. I don't know what the, I'm not a very astute baseball historian, and I'm not sure that anyone has come back from this kind of record to really make the playoffs, but I still think he can make a push. You know, it's a matter of just not getting swept. You know, I know the Reds are a good team, and getting swept by them, you know, understandable, but they had chances to win, you know, two or three of those games. And, you know, it's when you're losing two of three or getting swept by the Marlins, that's major red flags and sirens need to go off. And, you know, I think Sandy has realized that he's made a bunch of mistakes. And, you know, I think June 1st needs to be the date when it all starts. There needs to be like a all hands on deck meeting where it's like, this is what's happening. You know, I mean, I don't know that you can just, as a New York team in this market, I don't know that you can just let this happen. Not in this day and age where you just let your team deteriorate. And when the only day that fans look forward to is when Matt Harvey pitches. And even those aren't enjoyable because the Mets don't give him run support and he ends up with no decisions like they did with Johan.
Yeah, it almost is more as a Mets fan at this point. I agree with you. Matt Harvey's a must-watch. I was listening to the game through my phone, through the MLB app today, and you're excited. You know, you have to watch or listen every time that guy pitches. But it's almost even more frustrating because you see this guy who is as talented as any young pitcher in baseball, and it's like, we can't even win when this guy's pitching. You know what I'm saying? And he's throwing gems. Even when they win, you know, he's not getting the win, and it's like, I think he's got the good enough mental makeup to get through all this, and I don't think he's gonna, you know, fall into bad habits or anything because he's not getting wins. But it almost makes it more frustrating when he pitches. At least when Dylan G pitches and they stink, They're like, all right, well, they didn't hit for Dylan G, but they weren't going to win anyway. But when they don't hit for a guy like Harvey, you're like, God, you know, even when he won last week, and Kevin, to his credit, talked about it, he's like, the only time he's going to win is if he could drive in the runs and do it with a stick, and then he goes 2-for-3 with 2 RBIs last game, and he needed every one of those runs to win the game.
Yeah, it's tough, and, you know, I don't know that Nice is really, you know, I've been hard on him in the past, but you got to start to wonder, like, is he's not, you know, a 1 or 2. He's probably a 4 on most teams, I think. And, you know, he might have something wrong physically. He's one of those guys that just doesn't come out and say, hey, this has been bothering me, because he doesn't want the backlash from teammates maybe or the press. But, you know, they're scrambling for arms. They're scrambling for what's most upsetting to me is the fact that when they have they get runners in scoring position. That happens every game. But their average when they do have that happen is so horrific. I mean, they get, and it's not just like they come up and they have a 7 or 8 up with guys in runners in scoring position. It's guys like Ike Davis, and the big bats are supposed to come through, you know, and even Wright to a certain extent is guilty. So that's been a bugaboo for them for 2, 3, maybe 4 years now, where it's like, you know, at least last year in the first half of the season, if they had 2 outs, but they had runners in scoring position, they somehow found a way to get them in. It's just not happening this year, and that's been the difference. And, you know,
the only guys that come up with clutch hits are pinch hitters. You know, pinch hitting roles. You see Mike Baxter come up with, you know, big time hits in a pinch hitting role. Jordani Valdespin. Last I saw, and it was last night, I don't know if he came up with runners in scoring position today, but Ike Davis is betting 0-98 with runners in scoring position. The guy's got 150 at bats this year. I mean, how much time are they going to give him? Like you said, the guy has 6 extra base hits, Neil. 6. Tejada has 10, and he stinks.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, yeah, I mean, if I'm, I don't know, I'm speechless. You know, it's stupefying how you can have that. And what's crazy to me is, like, they're not, people are saying season's already over, like, you know, sending the clowns. But, like, when I look at last year's standings, they threw up the Reds, the National League Central standings last year. The Reds had some, like, 90-some-odd wins, and the next team back was 9 games back. In my mind, that next team down that's 9 games back, the season is what? April, May, June, July, August, September. You know, six months. That's a 1.5 wins per month. That's all it is. That's all it comes down to. And so that's why, you know, I kind of, you know, was down on April and May baseball. But when you have games like today, when they're tied 4-4, and frickin' Bobby Parnell comes in, and they have and gives up 3 runs, you know, that's a winnable game. You're in a winnable position.
Yeah.
If you win that game, okay, so you didn't win the series, but you got that win. And if you pull that stunt the next month, that's a win. The next month is a win. These little wins that seem insignificant at the time, they add up. And, you know, towards the end of the season, instead of being 6 games back, you're tied for the division title. So it, you know, it's not like, I don't feel like they're getting blown out. I mean, they do get blown out, but, like, there are games where they're in a position to win, you know, and they're getting outplayed to a certain extent, but it's the fact that it's because they don't take advantage of the opportunities that are given to them.
I couldn't agree more, Neil. It's like, but my question is, The reason, and I'm the most optimistic Mets fan there is, but it's like, who's going to turn around? I have no hope that Ike Davis is going to turn things around. I think Ruben Tejada will come back to some degree. And, you know, John Buck, which might almost be a blessing in disguise, I mean, has fallen down, you know, crashed way past down to earth. He's down 1,000 feet below the surface at this point. I mean, he was a stud in the first month of the season, but his May has been awful. But that's almost like, okay, that gives us the idea that possibly they could move him around the trade deadline and call Darno up, because somebody will need his services as a backup catcher with Pop. And maybe they'll get a relief pitcher for him or something like that, and then you open the gates for Darnell. But I just don't see it. I don't, unless their pitching can just become lights out, which could happen. I mean, Markham has been atrocious, but he's always been good throughout his career. I mean, I could see Markham bouncing back, Neese bouncing back, and then all of a sudden you start to say, well, yeah, they could stay in games with their pitching. They start getting some of these clutch hits. They start getting a blooper here to fall. I mean, we're making a lot of assumptions that need to go right for them to happen. But, I mean, there's still an outside chance, but we got to come out of this season with knowing who the core is. And right now, on the offensive side, the only two guys I'm confident are part of the future are Wright and Murphy. I would say Duda is on the bubble of being a guy I'm pretty confident in because at least we know what we got. And, you know, he is what he is, not a great hitter, but a professional hitter who can give you some pop and get on base. And Ruben Tejada, I think he's better than what he's shown. He still gives you good at-bats. He just, you know, he's putting the balls in play. It's not like he's striking out like Ike Davis is. He's just flying out. That's something that's correctable. I still think, although he hasn't been great in the field, he's a good defensive shortstop. I'm fine with going forward with him as my eighth hitter. But that's all. And is that enough? I mean, there's a lot of holes to fill next offseason, and that's a lot of pressure on Travis Darnell.
Yeah, and, you know, as a Mets fan, you've kind of seen guys that have been thrown into the fire and have fallen by the wayside, you know, and I think that's why a lot of the management, if they know their Mets history, has been kind of gun-shy when in terms of pulling the trigger and bringing guys up. But, you know, I think that's more – I don't know if it, you know, you obviously want to learn from your past, but I don't know that necessarily that, you know, those guys, were they handled correctly, you know, and I keep making reference to Generation K, but, you know, that was a situation where there was a lot of expectation and hype placed upon those guys, and they were kind of thrown into the fire, but who are the handlers, right? Who are the supporting staff? Who are the crew around them to kind of say, hey, you know, tough break, come back and get them. You know, a lot of, you know, you can put a lot of the onus on the player or the decision to bring them up, but also, like, who's there holding their hand or, you know, giving the support that they need in order to bounce back? And, you know, you take a look at Harvey, and, I mean, it's kind of worked with him, and I think you use him as an example, and you impart. He's now been cast as this savior, right? He's now been positioned. They have Harvey Day. They have T-shirts, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's Harvey mania right now. And so I feel like – and he's kind of took it in stride, and he's still performing. And I feel like, you know, maybe you bring up Wheeler and you just say, hey, attach yourself to Matt Harvey. Stick on his hip. And you say to Matt, we're bringing up Zach, you just, you know, show him the ropes. And that's
yeah, you know, he is quite an anomaly, Matt Harvey, in the fact that he was not overly dominant in minor league. And he had the same kind of question mark as Wheeler. And they brought him up. I mean, his major league numbers are by far better than his minor league numbers. I don't know many pitchers that have done that. It's not like it's just a few games. I mean, this guy's got like 20 games under his belt. And he's been just lights out from the moment he took the field. And maybe that's what they need to hope that happens with Wheeler. I mean, you know, you wait for a guy to be completely polished in the minor league, you might be waiting 5 years, you know. And if they had done that with Harvey, he probably would still be in the minors. But they gave him a shot, and he hit the ground running. And maybe that's what they need to do, just have Wheeler get called up in June as opposed to waiting towards the end of the season. Once he's healthy, gets a couple starts under his belt. I know he was throwing today. Let him get 3-4 starts under his belt in Vegas and bring him up and say, look, Matt Harvey, you know, attach yourself to Matt Harvey. He's going to show you how to make the transition. He did it better than anybody in recent memory, transitioning from the minors to the majors, and then go from there. But you know what? I'm done talking about the Mets. We spent a half an hour talking about the Mets and how bad they are. I need to be cheered up a little bit. So cheer myself up. I'm going to transition over to the New York Knicks, failing to get out of the second round of the NBA playoffs. I had predicted they wouldn't make it out of the first, so I'll admit I was wrong on that. But it was very satisfying to watch them get beaten up by the Indiana Pacers and listen to the Knicks fans just hanging on to hope after hope. they were going to come back from 3-1, and then they clearly couldn't do it. And their elimination game was just a microcosm of their season. Every foul, they were throwing their hands up. They were settling for jump shots instead of taking the ball to the rim. And that's what the Knicks were. And then what made the Knicks so good at the beginning of the year with a bunch of different guys scoring for them. I mean, Jason Kidd was non-existent. And then the only offensive threat they coming off the bench was that kid Copeland, who I don't think got enough time. So the question is, and we don't have to spend a whole lot of time on the Knicks, but the question is, well, the Knicks, they got a lot of contracts that extend out beyond even next season. So it's not like they have the expiring contracts where they could trade them. They got a lot of these guys locked up for multiple years, Novak, Chandler, Melo, Stoudemire, even Kidd signed a multi-year deal. All these guys, are they going to be better or worse next year? And if you think they're going to be better, how are they going to be better? How are they going to do it?
I actually think they're going to be worse. From what I've heard, J.R. Smith is a free agent, correct?
He is. He's got a player option, I think a player option is really low. So I think it's like $2 million, so he's going to opt out of it and become a free agent. So he'll probably go.
Right, and if you looked at their success down the stretch, J.R. Smith was a huge part of that. And you saw what happened in the playoffs. When he went cold, they were not getting the kind of point output they needed to win, considering the level of defense that they give you. Amari is just a huge burden on their wallet, and to a certain extent, so is Chandler. You know, I know that he defensively is one of the best in the league, but you saw what happens. You can't just rely on Melo. You know, he'll give you 39 points, but that's it. And you look at the other teams that are successful in the league. You saw what happened with Kevin Durant without Russell Westbrook. Everyone thought, oh, Durant will come through. You know, he's a scoring leader. He's a scoring champion from the regular season. Yeah, he loses Harden. He loses Westbrook. And he can't do it himself. And that's why the big three has been such a success when it first started with the Boston Celtics, and then now we take a look at the Miami Heat being the epitome of the big three. You need those two other supporting guys to pick you up when you're down, or even when you're performing well and shooting through the roof. One guy can't do it all, and I think that to a certain extent the Warriors experienced that with Steph Curry. You know, he can put up a bunch of buckets, but they're still going to lose because you still need defense and you still need a supporting cast around you. So I honestly think, considering their salary situation, that the Knicks are going to be worse. So a lot of people are saying that, they'll still make the playoffs. They'll probably be a lower seed, but they'll probably make a first-round exit. I think this was probably one of the best shot that they were going to get. I said they were going to go to the Eastern Conference Finals and lose to the Heat, but that was after you saw a bunch of guys really outperforming and really playing above what they can do, in Felton and in Shumpert and in Jason Kidd. So to me, it's like, they'll make the playoffs, but it won't be anything special, and I don't expect much.
Yeah, I'm the same. I mean, they're going to be a playoff team, no doubt, and they might even be a top four team. But I don't see them staying up in the two-seed range. Their youngest, they only have one guy on their entire roster, not even a starter, but on their entire roster under the age of 27. That's Iman Shumpert, who I think is going to be part of their future. I think they got to bring back J.R. Smith, and I know I'm in the minority and I'm not a Knicks fan. I know a lot of Knicks fans are just sick of him and his streakiness and all. But I think that his bad playoff play makes him affordable to some extent. I mean, people were talking about this guy commanding, $10 million a year type contract. I don't think he's going to get that out in the open market. So I think the Knicks will be able to afford to bring him back. And I think that he's going to be able to offer more than anybody else they're going to be able to pick up with their limited salary cap availability. So I do think they need to bring J.R. Smith back, which basically puts them with the same roster as last season. And how is that going to be any better? I mean, you can't imagine Carmelo Anthony playing any better than he did this year. The guy was a scoring champion. And, and he's not going to be any better than he was. You got to hope that he could play up to the capability he did this year. You're going to have to deal with Amari, like you mentioned. Tyson Chandler is still very good. I still like him, but you saw, he did look old in those playoffs. I know he was going into the playoffs with an injury, but they thought he was completely healthy coming out of that Boston series. But, you know, the guy's asking for help on Roy Hibbert. You know, you start to question, what are we paying all this money for? You know, the guy's making $15 million a year, and he can't cover Roy Hibbert. And so that's what you're paying him for. So they're going to be coming to camp next year with essentially the same roster, a year older. And, you know, I'm with you. I mean, I see them being probably upper 40s win to possibly even a 50-win team. But that's about it. And I think that's not what the Knicks fans envisioned when they got Melo and all of this. And, you know, you look at where Melo left, Denver's in a much – they have much rosier future than the New York Knicks. So that makes me happy, too, that this guy demanded this trade to get out of that town. And I'm sure you look back now, he'd be loving living life over there in Denver because they got a much brighter future going forward. But let's go over to the NFL a little bit. A couple big stories broke today we can get to. Obviously, the biggest one probably is the Urlacher retirement. You know, he had said on ESPN radio a few months ago that he basically, you know, he wasn't going to get himself ready and prepare himself this offseason for, you know, $1 million or $2 million. He wanted a team to show him that they really wanted him there, and he would then put in the time and all that. And that offer did not come. He wound up retiring as a Bear, which I think is good overall for football. You can guide it to lifetime Bear, clearly a Hall of Famer. What do you think about Urlacher and, you know, his career? Is he going to be, you know, 20 years from now, are we going to be talking about him as one of the better middle linebackers we've ever seen? Or is he going to just fade into, okay, yeah, he was very good. What do you think?
I think he's a Bears legend. I don't know that he's necessarily like an all-time NFL great. I mean, I don't put him in the same boat as Dick Butkus or Reinitzky or the guys that really, you know, Jack Hamm, the guys that really struck fear into your hearts. I mean, you know, he was a guy that was tough, but, you know, he had towards the tail end of his career, I want to say the last 3 years, 4 years maybe, you know, after their Super Bowl run and, you know, maybe, you know, fantasy championship run that they had. He's a guy that he's not making a whole lot of tackles in the backfield. He doesn't have a whole lot of tackles for losses. Now, from a stats standpoint, he doesn't wow you or blow you away. But maybe from like a teammate, from a leader standpoint, from a captain standpoint, yeah, he's pretty good. And he has that ability to rally the troops and really bring the team together and a team that can believe in you. But that doesn't, you know, as in terms of from a number standpoint or, you know, just strictly from an intimidation, you know, if you're looking just at that kind of angle, I mean, I don't really, you know, and maybe I'm completely off on this, but I just don't see it. I didn't see a lot of, like, you know, bone-crunching hits, you know, a lot of snot bubbles coming out of the nose. I mean, this is a guy that, you know, he did his work. He was a hard worker and, you know, a perfect fit for Chicago, and I think he'll be forever remembered in Chicago. But in terms of the grand scheme of things in the long run, I don't know that he's going to transcend that regional level into a national icon for years to come.
I actually kind of disagree with you. I mean, I think he was a guy that teams offensively have to try to game plan against. I think he was that impactful, especially in the first 8 or 9 years of his career. I agree that he kind of tailed off towards the end, and everybody except Ray Lewis did that to some extent. But I do think he was that kind of impactful player. And I just have a feeling this guy, his legend is going to kind of grow even more. I think the Bears fan base is kind of a nationwide fan base. You find Bears fans everywhere. There's Bears fans here in Norwalk. There's Bears fans in New York City. They kind of have that following all around. And I think that, you know, he's going to be one of those trendy jerseys to have 20 years from now that you've got, oh, you've got the Urlacher jersey, which is kind of going to make his legend grow a little bit. I think that's just my opinion. I think that he was, I mean, we could agree the guy's a Hall of Famer, I think. And people forget about the kind of freak athlete he was. I mean, when he was in college in New Mexico, guy used to return kicks and would score touchdowns. I mean, this guy is a huge beast of a guy that would be able to return kicks and punt and all. You know, the speed of a safety, really, at the middle linebacker position is pretty rare. I think people forget about the kind of athlete he was early on in his career. So I kind of think his legend is going to grow a little bit. And you know, we're doing the show 20 years from now, and it's simulcast around the world. We're going to be taking calls about Brian Urlacher, I think. Another big story that broke today in the NFL, the Michael Crabtree injury. This guy tore his Achilles during OTA workouts. He already has had surgery. I had surgery like the same day. I had it today. I think it happened today or yesterday. Tore his Achilles. I mean, they say 6 months, but yeah, torn Achilles. I know Terrell Suggs came back ridiculously fast from it, but for a wide receiver who needs his explosion, this is probably a season-ending injury, I think. I don't think we're going to see him be very impactful at all, even if he's able to come back for 2013. So what does that do to the Niners? I mean, they already have probably the deepest roster in all of football. What does that do to them? I mean, he became a superstar, really, towards the end of last year into the playoffs and was clearly the target of choice for Colin Kaepernick. What does this do to them? And is this now put like a little wrinkle in their Super Bowl hopes?
Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, I don't know that, you know, that much of the offense revolves around him getting touches. You know, to me, it didn't seem like, you know, it's a loss for sure. It's definitely a huge loss. I think getting Bolden, despite his age, will help soften the blow a little bit. You know, it might. Are they going to lose a game or two or three or, you know, a significant amount to miss the playoffs because Crabtree's not around? I don't think so. I mean, I think they have plenty of guys on that roster to step up and really deliver, you know, and having Bolden there will definitely help. I mean, but they have a couple of young guys on their roster that maybe didn't see a lot of playing time last year that could probably step in and at least get you a couple of key receptions to, you know, help with production, you know, seeing as Crabtree was the leading receiver last year. But, you know, they still have Manningham. Despite what his critics say, he has the potential to be a guy that can have a breakout game or two. You know, Vernon Davis is still a part of that offense. They have a bunch of really quality running backs that I think that they could, you know, if they'd be smart about it, they could probably, you know, utilize as like a slot or wing back or slot receiver. So, I mean, I wouldn't be too worried if I'm a 49ers fan. I mean, obviously it's huge, but, you know, I think that with the additions that you made, with the draft that you had, that, it, you know, at worst, you're minus one. You know what I mean? You chalk up maybe one loss because you don't have that kind of guy. I don't know that his loss of output is going to really result in that in too many losses.
Yeah, you know, he came into the league at Texas Tech, and you know, he had an insane career at Texas Tech, but kind of everybody does. But you know, he in the NFL, he's kind of more of a possession type guy, I think. You know, great hands and makes those kind of plays, which was huge for a guy like Kaepernick coming in, you know, getting, you know, second year guy getting his first real taste at starting. So I think that was huge for him to have a guy like that. That being said, I think they have so much talent on that team that they'll be able to find ways to move the football. I don't think that's going to be a problem. They'll be able to run the ball well. I think Kaepernick will just find another target, and you're going to find somebody fantasy-wise next year on that roster. And, you know, it's crazy as it sounds, even if it's a Ted Ginn or somebody like that who now comes up and, you know, came into this league as a first-round pick at wide receiver and basically now all he does is return punts. You know, maybe he steps up and becomes a playmaker on offense. I agree. It is an injury that will impact them, but I don't know that it's going to, like, really have that much of a impact on whether they make the playoffs or go on. They'll find a way. They have one of the best coaches in football. They got an electric quarterback. They got other weapons. You know, you're going to need guys like Vernon Davis to step up. Like you said, Mario Manningham, I think, can step up and can show him that he could do that and be a playmaker. So I don't know. We'll see what's going on. We got a couple callers waiting on hold patiently, so I'm going to get out to one, Neil. We're going to line one. You are on with the Tri-State Sports Guys. Welcome aboard. Who's this?
This is John Nicklaus. How y'all doing tonight?
Hey, John, how you doing tonight, buddy?
You know, other than the fact that I watched Jose Bautista just own my Tampa Bay Rays, it's been a pretty uneventful day.
Yeah, you had a couple home runs today, right?
He actually accounted for all four RBIs today. He had a two-run shot, a solo shot to tie it up bottom of the ninth, and the walk-off single in the bottom of the tenth.
Jesus. I mean, it's amazing the talent that Toronto front of Blue Jays team has, and they can't win games. But you know what? Your Rays are hanging in there. So what else you got for us today, John?
Oh, I wanted to talk about the Michael Crabtree injury. It did happen yesterday at OTAs, which it's a terrible injury because he proved last year he was having a great year, a breakout year, 85 grabs, 1,100 yards, 9 touchdowns. He was the guy Kaepernick focused on the whole time during the Super Bowl, it seemed. It's a shame to see him get hurt. And the last guy I remember, last receiver I remember having an Achilles injury, was Todd Pinkston for the Eagles. And if you guys remember, he never came back right. So I'm really worried to see what happens to Crabtree now, because he was proven last year that he was breaking out. He was looking pretty darn good.
I do remember the Pinkston injury, actually. And that guy was showing some signs about, you know, becoming a real wide receiver, you know, in this league. And, you know, Chris Carter was on ESPN radio this afternoon, and I was listening to him. And, you know, he's talking a little bit about the injury and what happens and, you know, obviously the impact it has at the wide receiver position. But the surgery actually, you know, to reattach that Achilles tendon, that is now shorter than your other leg. I mean, that's something you can never get back. I mean, to reattach that's not something that you could build up the strength. That tendon is now shorter on that leg than it is on your other leg. So I kind of tend to agree with you. He's never going to be the same type player he was. But the question is, what are the Niners going to do to fill in that void?
Well, since Ted Ginn has left the building, we're now looking at A.J. Jenkins. You're looking at, Mario Manningham. I mean, they have the talent there at wide receiver. They do. I believe they drafted one or two this year in the draft. You have a Michael James, who can be in a Dexter McCluster role out of the slot. But that means that, it just feels very tough to fill that void because Crabtree is such a good receiver and he was number one. So you need Manningham to come back healthy from an ACL injury, and there's another tough injury that is hard to come back from. And you have A.J. Jenkins, a first-round pick last year, who essentially had no playing time. So now you're bringing him along. You're talking about taking away snaps from LaMichael James at running back, where he proved last year he was pretty good. And it creates a problem that I don't know if it ruins the Niners, but it surely does not help them out, especially with the Seahawks, who got better in this draft.
Yeah, I agree with you there. And you know, A.J. Jenkins, I'm glad you brought him up, because he's an interesting guy. Like you said, I mean, first-round pick in 2012, I think he's only active for a handful of games, and I don't even know if he recorded a stat. And so I don't know. I don't follow the Niners well enough to know exactly what this guy's issues was, if it was a problem with him, you know, learning the playbook or his work ethic or whatever. But you wonder, a guy like that is clearly talented to justify a first-round pick by a team who tends to have very good drafts. You know, they don't tend to miss these, you know, on guys like that. So it was interesting to see him not get any playing time. I don't know if you can lend any insight into A.J. Jenkins. I mean, what was his deal? Why was he inactive all season?
A.J. Jenkins had a little bit of a tough time handling the playbook. Coming from Illinois, where I have connections up in Illinois because my family's from up there, and I will tell you that their playbook is really simple. So it became a complex scheme for him to learn in San Francisco. Not only that, but he also had a guy by the name of Randy Moss in front of him. And we had Ted Ginn, who obviously they had a lot of faith in last year. You know, he was a former first-rounder himself. Granted, did he earn the number 9 pick? He's still a bust, but he still proved that he was a pretty reliable slot receiver. So A.J. was just battling for playing time, and it stunned me when A.J. didn't get playing time after Mario's injury. But, you know, when you can't pick up the playbook, I'm not going to play you. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, that's a fact of the league, you know, and maybe another year under his belt, who knows what kind of, you know, he might see this opportunity and say, all right, this is time for me to, you know, hunker down and learn this thing, and this is, might be my last shot, because wide receivers, they got a short life. There's always a whole new crop coming in every year who can run fast and catch the ball. So, you know, you a couple years of you not learning that playbook, and people are just, okay, on to the next one. So maybe he sees his opportunity. I hope they do. I mean, not that I root for the Niners, but they're a fun team to root for. They got a coach that's easy to root for. As a guy, you know, I'm a Jet fan, so I got no heart, you know, I got no hatred for the Niners. So it'll be interesting to see. Well, John, thanks for calling in, buddy, and keep listening, brother.
Always. Thank you, guys.
All right. Thank you. All right. Well, Neil, I mean, what did you make of that? I mean, you know, I was going to bring up A.J. Jenkins, actually, because I remember the draft. When they selected him last year, and it was kind of an interesting pick, but they were talking about, you know, at the time, another weapon for Alex Smith, and he was non-existent. And I had to look him up and see what happened to the guy. And he was actually a guy that would get drafted in fantasy drafts last year because people thought he'd be all right. And he became non-existent. So, I mean, there's a chance that a guy like A.J. Jenkins can step up and become a 40 or 50 catch guy. I don't know. What do you think, Neil?
That's going to be a situation where someone like Bolden takes him under his wing, because if our caller was correct, and you know he can't the playbook is like Sanskrit. I don't see him bouncing back. I mean, we saw what happened with Chad Johnson in New England. You know, I just think that's a situation where he's got to get into a more simplified offensive game plan somewhere. So maybe he's got trade value. You know, that's when a guy can't be active because he doesn't know how to read a playbook. I mean, that is brutal. And, you know, if you're at San Francisco and you see what happened with Crabtree, maybe now's the time to pull the strings on a trade. You know, I'm kind of trade happy today, Mike. I don't know if you picked up on that.
Yeah, what's up with that, Neil? Everything's a trade with you. Like one of those crazy callers who wants to, you know, these crazy trades. Now, the only thing that worries me again about this guy, A.J. Jenkins, and this is the last time we talk about A.J. Jenkins today, I promise, but you would think, now I don't pretend to know the ins and outs of the 49ers playbook, but you would think once Kaepernick took over, they must have simplified the playbook to some extent. A guy who had no experience starting in the NFL, only had 1 year experience on the bench his rookie season, you would have to think they'd simplify it. And you would think that if this guy can't even learn the simplified playbook for a first-year starter, what the hell is this guy doing? I don't know. Maybe I'm looking too far into it. Maybe they didn't change the playbook for Colin Kaepernick. I don't know. Well, I don't know enough about it. But I'm just going by, you know, NFL history. When you've got a young quarterback in there, you make things a little simple for him. Break down the cut the field in half, easy read, not a lot of options from the wide receivers, that type of thing. And if he can't pick that up, maybe I am being a little too optimistic about A.J. Jenkins.
Well, if you look at what San Francisco did, they kind of followed the path that Washington did, in that Washington really adapted a lot of Baylor's playbook. When RG3 was at Baylor, they incorporated a whole lot of packages and plays from that system. And I think that San Francisco kind of saw that and followed suit with what Kaepernick was doing at Nevada. So, I mean, it really wasn't simplifying the system. In a way it's simplifying the system because you're making it simple for that player. You're not dumbing down the plays necessarily. You're going with what they know. So that's how you're simplifying it. I don't want people to think that they're only running basic vanilla packages. They're running what the quarterbacks know from their previous experiences in college. And so, Illinois didn't really necessarily run that kind of system, you know, when AJ was there. So, to me, it's, you know, I have little to no faith at this point. I'm kind of, and like I said, I'm trigger happy. Like if you don't buy in and you don't get it, I don't know that I want to spend too much time wasted on you. You know, life is short, YOLO.
All right, well, you know what? Here's what I'm willing to do. You could have Santonio Holmes. Give me a nice bag of balls. Give me a nice, whatever the cuisine is up in San Francisco. I don't even know what they eat up there. Something nice, season tickets to the Giants. And I'm good to go. You could have Santonio Holmes. He stinks. Go trade him away. We'll free up some money. You eat that salary, God bless you. We'll send them. I'll buy the ticket. Tri-State Sports guys will buy that ticket. send Santonio Holmes over there, get him out of my life. The only other football story we were going to talk about, and without Tony here, it kind of loses a little of the luster because I wanted to poke fun at Tony, even though the story itself isn't that funny. You know, the story of Mario Williams is comical in that, you know, signs this big contract. We talked about it on the show. Tony was a little bit even, you know, hesitant to celebrate here as a Bills fan when they signed him, because they signed him for so much money. And he said, well, you know, I don't think that, you know, D-line is going to have that kind of impact to justify the kind of money they spent. But then he buys an $875,000 engagement ring for his girlfriend. She calls it off. He wants the money back. She says he broke it off, all this. And then she releases these tweets that say, in the middle of the season, this guy was contemplating suicide. This guy spent 3 months up in Buffalo. That's all it takes. And he's just miserable. I mean, what do you make of that? I wanted to make fun of Tony. He's not here. But, I mean, what do you make of Mario Williams? Is this how far he's in, how quickly this guy's fallen? Well, he's kind of just like a joke. I mean, this guy was a stud.
Yeah, I mean, you remember on draft day back in the day, you know, Houston made it widely known, and they publicized, heavily publicized the fact that they were going to make him the number one. There was no bones about it, and that Reggie Bush, I believe it was Reggie Bush, was going to have to take a back seat. And so,
yeah, it was Reggie Bush, because it was a big deal. You know, Reggie Bush was this can't-miss guy. And then up until last year, it was like geniuses.
Yeah, and, you know, he gets the nickname Super Mario, and, you know, Houston, he doesn't necessarily meet expectations. I think he had, you know, decent career there. And, you know, but, I mean, did anyone, and Tony D included, did anyone think that he was going to go there and he was going to turn around that franchise? I mean, I honestly can't fathom anyone in a position to turn around that franchise. I just feel like it's a epidemic up there. It's systemic, you know. I really think it's a wholesale change. I don't know that one guy's going to come in there and be able to really change and shake things up. And so, you know, if that, and it goes back to your support staff, your supporting cast, right? You got to have a good supporting cast. You can't be on an island, right? And you know, Buffalo is the kind of environment where you really need a better than average support staff to let you know, hey, you know, you're the guy, but, you know, it's you just have to have someone there to comfort you. I know that sounds really cheesy and whatnot, and it sounds like, you know, it's counterintuitive to what we think of when we think of the sports mentality, that tough, rough and tough mentality, but you got to have someone there for you on your side to be like, Mario, dude, chill out. It's totally cool. Like,
yeah,
you just need to take a step back, take a breather. You went down this road. You went down this path. It's not over, and you can just get back on track. It's not going to be a quick process, but, you know, I think that hopefully he just realizes that, you know, it's a bump in the road. You know what I mean? Bump of the road. It's temporary, my parents would always say. It's temporary.
Well, there you go, Neil. Your parents are very optimistic. I like that. Now, you would think a town like Buffalo, again, I haven't been to Buffalo, but just what I know of Buffalo, you would think it's like one of those places that would force teammates to befriend each other and become a close-knit unit, because it's not like they're all parting ways and going to the 40-40 club or, you know, doing this and that. I mean, you're in Buffalo. You're probably just sitting at your buddy's house playing video games. I don't think there's a lot to do at night. So I think that you would think that there would be a support staff by just default up in Buffalo, because what the hell else are you doing but hanging out with your teammates? You know, I don't think the talent level of the women up there is up to snuff. Right? It's just my opinion. So you would think that that would already be built in. That being said, I don't think that this guy's, like, done. I could see him coming back and having double-digit sacks, you know, season after season. Again, I think he can come back and be that player. I don't want to see it as a Jet fan. I don't think that I know he's playing through some pain last year. I think he could bounce back. It's just amazing at how quickly, I mean, what we were talking about Mario Williams this time last year, and this year it's like a sideshow. It's kind of bizarre. But we have spent plenty of time on Ike Davis, A.J. Jenkins, and Mario Williams in the Buffalo Bills. So now, Neil, you got any duty serious topics for us? I missed it last week. I was trying to get Cowboy to give me a couple, but you're back. I hope you got a couple solid do to you serious topics. What do you got, dude?
I got a couple. I don't want to, you know, ruin the loser fest that we have going on right now.
We are just a depressing show. My God.
Well, here's something that'll brighten your day, at least if you're a Giants fan. Under Andy Reid's regime, control, power, whatever you want to say, the Eagles used to have Taco Tuesdays and Fast Food Fridays.
I heard that story, which is fantastic. And the new guy's got, like, grilled chicken or something.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not that shouldn't come as a shock or surprise if you've ever seen Andy Reid with your own two eyes and you're not blind, that something like that was probably going down in camp. But it's kind of interesting to me that when you're trying to build a championship team or a squad and you're trying to get everyone focused and, you know, living a healthy lifestyle and getting everyone on board with what you're trying to do, and you're throwing like KFC and Taco Bell and like all this garbage at them. You know, I mean, I can't imagine that puts them in a mood to go out there. It sedates them, does it not? Where it's like, you know, you're at this point where you're just feeling slothful and gluttonous, and you don't exactly want to line up against some guy who's been, you know, throwing down protein shakes and, you know, bars and whatnot. I just, you know, I'm probably overstating it, but that to me is just, it's a little excessive. Maybe Taco Tuesday is cool, but Fast Food Fridays, Andy, good Lord.
Neil, you're understating it. Neil, this is insane that this guy would have this. I mean, for all that we know now about nutrition, I mean, we had a nutrition coach at Johns Hopkins. You know,
yeah.
We had that big guy who played basketball at Maryland, whatever his name was. It was our nutrition coach at Johns Hopkins baseball. And the Philadelphia Eagles, one of the most successful franchises, albeit without any championships over the last decade and a half, but this is a team that's perennially deep into the playoffs behind one of the most successful regular season coaches we've seen in a generation. And the secret of his success is Taco Tuesdays and Fast Food Fridays. If I have – and I love tacos. I mean, I could eat Mexican food every meal of the day. If I eat tacos for lunch, I'm shot for the day. I'm like sluggish. It's like that Kevin James thing where he said he feels like a bear shot with a tranquilizer gun. I'm just going through the motions. So the idea of just like eating some tacos and then having some guy in brackets lining up against you just huffing taco breath all over you, those aren't productive practices. That's insane, dude. You're understating the how crazy that story is, that they have to implement we're eating healthy food now as professional athletes. It's crazy.
Well, then you're going to love this next Dude, Are You Serious story. It involves...
That's why you're great at the segues, Neil. You always got a segue for me, brother.
We're all familiar, especially recently with the performance that the Mets put up. We're all familiar with Aroldis Chapman. Yes, he's a flamethrower, if you will.
Yep, he's got a tattoo that says 103.9 or something because that's a hard throw.
Well, he didn't fare so well against the Phillies. That was the team they played before they came into Citi Field. He blew a save, I believe it was Sunday, maybe, Monday. Well, it turns out that it might have been because of the 18 Cuban pastries he ate before the game.
You know, they were maybe I only tuned in at the tail end of Boomer and Carton today, but they made some intern eat 18 pastries and then try to strike out Boomer with a wiffle ball. And I guess now it makes sense. That's what they were making fun of Aroldis Chapman. I had not heard this story though. That's pretty great. He had 18 pastries.
Yeah, and
like he's pledging a fraternity.
I can vouch for this because when I was in high school before football games. You know, my mom wasn't exactly a nutritionist, and she used to pump me full of chocolate chip pancakes before I'd head out into the field. And I tell you, the triple option is not fueled by chocolate chip pancakes, I'll tell you that much.
That's a lot of handoff to the fullback.
Yeah, that's a lot of dives. We'll get 2 yards, and we'll get him in the field position game.
Yeah, there's a lot of audibles at the line. Look, I'm going to give it to the fullback. I'm going to give it to old 42 here. We're going trapped because I got nothing.
And, you know, Ch- chocolate chip pancakes before a major football game, probably not a smart decision. Well, what about a Michigan State signee, a recruit by the name of Jay Harris, who decided, you know what, I don't need to play football on a scholarship. I'm going to pursue my rap career.
You know what? It's safer, although a lot of those guys get shot. You know, the typical career of an NFL guy is like 3 point, you know, something years. A lot of guys don't make it out of college. How is this guy as a rapper? Is he any good? I got to ask Tony D. He's our rap expert.
Yeah, I think Tony D has the mixtape that's available on SoundCloud or whatever is Napster these days.
We can make that tomorrow's song of the day. We'll got to forward that to Tony D. This cat's going to be our song of the day at some point this week.
Yeah, and you know, it's rap is cool. I mean, I thought I was a rapper for a little bit in high school. I wrote down some rhymes. I recorded it. You know, I thought about going public with it. But, you know, I said, you know,
Wait. Is that a true story? You did not record rap, yourself rapping. That's not a true story.
I don't have the notebook anymore. I wish I did, because that is going to be worth serious dough someday. But yeah, my going after my junior year in high school, going to senior year, if you saw a notebook in my hands, I was usually penning some serious words, lyrics, what have you. Yeah, and I just it was something that I like to do. I used to, Mike. I'm a loser. I mean, let's get serious for a second. I wrote poetry in sophomore year in high school, and then that poetry, it became street poetry my junior year heading into senior year. I got the creativity. It comes out of me. You know, all the pores, I got to record it. I got to get down on paper.
Well, the world needs to hear it, dude. You got a voice. You got to shout it. We got to find this notebook. It's probably, your mom has to have this notebook. She probably has it and is embarrassed about it and hasn't given it to you. I know your mom listens to the show. Can we please have a notebook? I would just want to hear one. I want to have just one a week. And that'll be your opening. Maybe your opening for Blackout will be just you rapping. You know, like Seinfeld did his like stand up at the beginning and like Louis C.K. does his thing at the Cellar. You could be, it'd be your thing, just rapping from, what was that, circa like 97, 96?
Yeah.
That was like the golden age of rock, dude.
Yeah, that was a lot of, you know, that was Biggie, that was Diddy, that was, I think it was a little bit before Jay-Z hit it big. A little remnants of Tupac mixed in there, a lot of Wu-Tang influence. So
yeah, Wu,
I mean,
I'm sure
was,
the Wu is just flowing through your veins, dude.
I got the swarm took over me. But, yeah, that notebook is probably under lock and key, buried deep underneath the Lynch estate, never to be seen again. But who knows? Maybe there will be a sinkhole and we'll discover it someday.
We're finding it. I'm going to make it a mission. I'm going to get like a Discovery show, a Discovery Channel show where we're searching. You know, they like try to find all these artifacts around America. We got to find this thing. I'm going to email them. That's another show idea. I got another show for Neil. Find this freaking notebook from 1996.
Well, we don't have to worry about finding Rick Riley's poetry, because that's pretty public. Have you read his latest?
You know, I have not read his latest. What's his latest?
Well, this is about the Jets, and I will read it for you now. It's kind of long, so strap in.
Okay.
QB or not QB? That is the question. Who should the Jets start? Who should the Jets shun? Dealt the hand of five, none of them a king. They have to find one. Can we redeal this thing? They cut Tim Tebow, a big deletion, 20 mag covers, 6 completions.
I don't like anything about it. The guy jumped the shark, that guy. He was literally to the last page of Sports Illustrated. Ever since then, you know, the guy thinks he's bigger than God. Shut up, Rick Riley.
Ugh. I never understood how.
As a Giants fan, do you read that and find it funny? No, seriously. I mean, is it funny? I don't find it funny, but maybe I'm just biased. I don't think I would find it funny if they would make fun of another guy either. It's cheesy. He's trying to be a schmoozer.
I read this and I thought you were going to read it to Jameson, you know, as like her bedtime story.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm going to read that to my daughter.
I mean, it goes on for another. It goes on for another, like, I don't know, 18 verses. But, I mean, it's amazing that he there's no one else. There's really, other than maybe you could throw Bob Costas into that mix of just like pompous, pretentious, overstated, like ridiculous, absurd diatribes and soliloquies. Rick Riley takes it to a whole nother level. I mean, a poem, and like none of what he does or says is based in fact or like has any kind of logic or reasoning. It's just fluff. It's all fluff. And he's made a career, a lucrative career out of it.
Oh, yeah. That guy's contract right now has got to be $1 million to sit there and do nothing. To just write, he thinks he's like the funniest guy on earth, but he's not. And I used to like him when I was 13, reading Sports Illustrated in my bedroom, but now he's just annoying. I don't read anything that guy writes. He doesn't bring anything to the table. I'd rather read Jason Whitlock, and I hate that guy.
Yeah, and it's funny you bring up the SI, because when I read SI religiously and I turned the page and I saw Rick Riley's picture, I knew that, okay, that's when I need to close the magazine and my reading is over. Oh.
All right,
was
that
God.
All you got? You got a great top 10 list. You got any more?
I got maybe two more. I got
right.
This one. You would think that Lance Armstrong would kind of quietly go into the night and to be forgotten and erased from the memories of everyone that has ever believed in heroes. But nope, he's back in the spotlight again. I don't know if you listen to the Howard Stern show at all, but a very becoming comedian by the name of April Macy, I believe her name is, was a guest on the show on, I think it was Monday morning. And apparently she had a little encounter with Lance Armstrong at one of his parties. She ended up detailing the exploits and saying that she was led into a bathroom, and Lance was at probably like a 90-degree angle, bent over, his posterior exposed to all that could see, even though it was a bathroom. And she was asked to dine.
Are you talking about maybe like fix the salad? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, toss the salad, basically, yeah. So, you know, I know Lance didn't really spend any time in prison prior to all this, but if he ever does go to prison, he'll probably have a really good time.
Well, he's preparing, yeah. I mean, this guy took what Ben Roethlisberger did in the bathroom to a whole different level. He won up Ben Roethlisberger. I mean, you think Ben Roethlisberger's a bad guy. This guy, I mean, that girl that Ben Roethlisberger took in there would say, I'll sign up for 10 more Ben Roethlisberger trips than one with Lance Armstrong.
Then one trip down Lance's Hershey Highway. Yeah, what I understand with this is this something, is this an acquired taste, pun intended? Is this something where it's like, it accidentally happened once while you're in a certain position, and then you were like, wow, that's amazing. I got to have more of that. Or is that something where it's just instinctively, like, you're born gay, you're just born liking your butt getting chowed out?
I can't even begin to answer that question. My mind immediately races to, that guy dated Sheryl Crow for how many years? She knows,
yeah.
Whether she partook or not, she knows about that little quirk in his game. She has to know about it. That comes up. That didn't just occur. Unless after the whole steroid thing came out, he just said, forget it. My life is, you know, he went off the deep end. You know, he was like, I finally could let myself go and be the man I really want to be. So maybe she didn't know about it. She was into the whole aura of what he, you know, wanted to portray himself as. And then once the emperor lost his clothes or whatever you say there, then it's just like, all right, this is what I've always wanted since I first took the training wheels off of my bike. And here it comes.
But, I mean,
you just
know.
Continue with it. I thought we got off of the depressing bandwagon. We're right back on it.
No, yeah. I mean, I just want to, well, you know, I feel like if we dish out enough sorrow and, you know, destitution or whatever, that'll make people feel better about their own lives, you know?
Well, this my top 10 is going to make me feel depressed about myself. But what, you got one more, you said?
Yeah, really quick. A Korean high school pitcher threw 178 pitchers in a start this past weekend. And word is he's averaging around 140 pitches a game. Now, that's, to me, 178 is like you say goodbye to your arm in about a week or so. But I wanted to bring your attention to the fact that I once threw 144 pitches in a complete game in college.
Is that right? I was on that team. Was I at that game?
It was against Catholic University, and I gave up 6 earned, but luckily we have a stacked lineup that gave us 9 runs, and I got the W. But, yeah, and I remember going to the bar afterwards, and I couldn't even pick up my draft of beer. I had to go lefty the entire night and probably for the rest of the week.
That's a bad job by Coach Babb. You know, he said it's a non-conference game, although Catholic was always very good. Non-conference game, he just says, you know what, Neil? Here's the ball. I'll see you in the ninth, brother. That's fantastic. I got to email Coach Babber about that. I don't know if he recalls that. That's a bad job by him.
Yeah. Well, he asked me, are you okay? And, of course, as a stubborn Scorpio, I said, yeah, of course. But, and, you know, my arm was like, you got to be crapping me, dude.
Yeah, he's like, come on, dude. What gives here? Yep, that's fantastic. 144, there you go. Well, we got a great, and I think, Tony, this is the reason why Tony D didn't come in studio this week, because I know Tony listens to some awful music. I know it. The guy told me today a couple weeks ago is of Monsters and Men. He made fun of me for liking Mumford and Sons. So what we decided was we were going to say top 10 songs or artists in general that you're embarrassed to say that you like. Now, you're a single guy, so... The way I'm judging this is if you're on your first date and you guys start talking about music, these are going to be 10 songs or artists or just musicians that you're not going to really admit you like until you're at the cuddling stage. So you want to go back, and I think this the best way this works if we go back and forth. So right. I'm going to start out with my number 10. I'm going to ease my way into this, but this is an embarrassing group to like. I like that group Fun. It's out right now. And I like that song that guy sings with Pink, and I don't like Pink. But my wife caught me singing along to that song not long ago, and that's when I realized, it's kind of embarrassing that I like this. And then I was like, well, I don't like Pink. I like Fun. And then I was like, that's even worse. So I guess that's a little embarrassing. I'm not buying their albums or downloading their stuff, but if any one of those Fun songs is on, or when they were on, Saturday Night Live, I'm checking them out. I like them.
Yeah. Yeah, I take issue with the way that they dress, but I feel like all bands dress really weird these days, so I guess I got to give them a pass because they're just, like, keeping up with the status quo in terms of music, fashion. But I'd rather just...
Everyone dresses in Brooklyn. You go to Brooklyn, they all look like Fun.
Yeah. But it's like, where's the Flood, dude? And, like, why are you dressed like you're from the 20s? And I don't know. It's just it's upsetting to me, so I have to close my eyes when they're on TV.
Who do you got at number 10?
Oddly enough, like the majority of the bulk of my songs are from my college days, because that was like our college days was not particularly a good period of time for music. If you remember, it was just like we just took whatever they gave us. But
a lot of Chumbawamba.
Yeah, and so the one that I would had on loop in college was "It Wasn't Me" by Shaggy.
I mean, I'll tell you, though, my roommate, Brett Berg, used to like that song. It was on his Napster account. So I would wake up many a morning to that song just blaring on a computer in my apartment. That's a catchy song. I don't think that's that embarrassing. I mean, again, I agree. You can't announce that on a first date. But that's not a horrible song. I think most people would agree that's a catchy tune.
It is, but I feel like it's such a dated piece of music, you know what I'm saying? And what's embarrassing for me is that song could come out right now and I would get down to it. That's not something like, I used to like it. It's like I still like it, and I think that's what's embarrassing about it.
You know, that guy, when Boombastic came out, they thought they could never match it. But you know what? He did, and I give him credit for that. I'm going to give you, you know what, I'm going to jump this one back to, this is embarrassing, but I'm going to jump this back to number 9 because this also came out of our college days, and this is definitely embarrassing, but I like, and I'm going to go with a whole, like, album, the Pure Moods DVDs, both 1 and 2. I could listen to Pure Moods right now, start to finish, it's like I'm listening to Dark Side of the Moon. I listen to both of them, start to finish. I can't get enough of Pure Moods. It really does. It puts you in a nice little state of mind, don't you think? And I don't even do drugs. I've never done drugs, but I'm just saying that's one of those things. It's like you might catch me just mellowing out some Pure Moods.
I don't think I've ever heard that.
I'm going to buy you a Pure Moods DVD. It'll change your life. I'm going to tell you now. You listen to Pure Moods start to finish now. You got to commit. Like, give me 60 full minutes. I'll change your life.
Yeah, I got to be in, like, a dark room, and, you know, maybe there's a black light on, but it sounds amazing. And, you know, I'm all for it. I mean, it just sounds like something that maybe might help, you know, cure the night terrors, take the edge off. Yeah, I'm down with it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. What do you got at number 9?
This one is before our college days, but like it's probably it's the only song from the 80s. But every time this thing comes on, I become like the biggest emo kid in the world. And I don't even know the band's name. But the band's name is Real Life, which it's ridiculous in itself, but their song, Send Me an Angel.
Oh, Neil. I almost don't wish you told me that. You like that song?
Yeah.
This
that
makes
that
me
thing
feel
comes
better
on,
about my list.
Yeah. That thing comes on, and I could be dead sober. I could be drunk. I could be, you know, I could be coming off a laughing fit. As soon as that song comes on, it's just like I turn into this ball of volunteers, and it's just I don't know what it is, but I close my eyes and I'm in a different world, and it's got this mesmerizing effect.
You get yourself a nice cry, attaboy, for Waterworks. That should be a song
yeah.
It comes out to when they announce the Giants. Waterworks Wilson, they play that song by Real Life. Oof. All right, my number 8, I'm going to go back to the soundtrack. I'm going to go 3 soundtracks in a row. So I gave you Pure Moods. Number 8, I got the Dreamgirls soundtrack. You ever catch that, like, start to finish? That's one of those movies I was like, I'm not watching this movie. It's going to be stupid. My wife made me watch it. That Jennifer Hudson song comes on, Neil. I don't care. I'll be in a meeting with President Obama. I say, look, Prez, you got to give me about 4.5 minutes because I got to hear Jennifer belt this one out. That's as good as it gets. But I can't admit that. I can't. I mean, I'm glad Tony D isn't here. He'll probably punch me in the stomach. You ever catch that whole soundtrack, the whole thing, Eddie Murphy singing? It's fantastic.
Did I ever catch the soundtrack? Did I ever watch the movie? I mean, it took me a second to realize which movie you were talking about.
Oh, Neil, you got to watch. I'm going to tell you, you like that movie. Great performances in that. It'll surprise you how good that movie is. It'll surprise you at what a dork I am that I like the movie. Either way, you should watch it just so you can either make fun of me or be enlightened as to what the music industry was like in the 70s or 60s, whatever. I don't know what freaking movie was out.
Here's the option. Here's the DVD feature I'm hoping for, and I'm hoping that someone invents this. But you know how when there's a video and they have they want the deaf people to understand what's going on? Like, say it's a press conference, a political press conference. They have, like, the sign language person kind of, like, in a bubble in the top right.
Yeah.
I would like to have a situation where you can watch a movie instead of having DVD commentary, you know, from the stars or the director. You can have someone like Mike D or your buddy in the bubble in the right hand corner just giving reactions and talking. So
I don't know that I want you to see me reacting to that movie. I mean the crap that they put Jennifer Hudson through in that movie, nobody should have to live through. I'll tell you that right now. Who do you got? And what is it we had? Number 8
here? Number 8, this stretch, 8 through 4, the rest are just ridiculous, but 8 through 4, you're going to wonder, like, what I've been smoking. Number 8, I have All the Things She Said by Tattoo.
I don't even know what you're talking about. I don't even know that song.
Tattoo's T-A-T-U. I think it's all caps. For some reason, stylized that way, but it's like two Russian sisters or twins who are just like smoking hot, and all the things she said, all the things she said, running through my head. This was like college style, like 99, 2000 maybe. Kind of techno, a little dance in there. But it's just, God, it's like, it's. It, I think if I didn't know that they were Russian and they were sisters, it probably would not have that great an impact on me. But just picturing them singing that to me, it's just like, ugh.
These girls, I just Googled it as you're talking about it, and these girls are sisters. They're like basically making out with each other. They're like, one of them's naked and the other one's holding her. One of them's pregnant and the other one's holding her belly. This is gross that they're sisters, dude. You got to really think.
Yeah,
bro, you can sisters.
They're close.
They're tight. Wow. Yeah. That's pretty bad. That's pretty gross that they're sisters. We got to confirm that they're sisters because that is, and I got to look into your background, brother. You got to be on a list or something. All right, we got 5 minutes left, so I'm going to tell you right now, for those listening live, we're probably going to go over. So if you want to catch us on bonus time, you're going to have to download the show tomorrow, or probably I think it comes up pretty quickly after the show is over to catch the end of our list here and our 5 and 10. Moving on to number 7, Neil, I told you I'm going to give you a couple soundtracks right in a row. This is a broad one, but I have to put it in there because my wife makes fun of me because I like this more than my daughter does, but I like Disney songs, all of them. Lion King, give me Aladdin, give me even like Pocahontas, that song about the colors of the wind and all that. I love all of them. You know? Like the glory days of Disney, like in the 90s, when they,
yeah,
like all of them had like really good. Even the other day, I'm watching with my daughter the Tarzan movie. And remember, if you remember, Phil Collins did that soundtrack, and it was outstanding. And, I love Disney movies, and I love the soundtracks just as much from that era. They don't really do it in Disney movies anymore, where they have, like, you know, original tunes. You know, like Toy Story's got the You Got a Friend in Me and all, but I don't think that's an original song. I think that's been around a while. That type of stuff. I love them. I can't get enough Disney music, and I get angry at the XM channel that's got the Disney music or kids music or whatever, and it's like Hannah Montana. It's not Disney songs from movies, and I think it's kind of a ripoff.
Yeah, it was almost like an opera to a certain extent, to that kind of quality of, you know, like a big-time Broadway play with moving ballads and that kind of thing. It's you don't get that anymore. It's all been covered in pop sugar or whatever you call it.
Yeah, atrocious. So who do you got at your number 7?
Here's another. This one's from the 90s. Might be mid-90s. Could be early 90s. I don't know. 93, 94 maybe. A group or band or musician named D-Light, and it's the title is called Groove is in the Heart.
Never heard. I don't even know most of the songs on your list, man.
Groove is in the heart. Groove is in the heart.
Is this one of the songs from your notebook, Neil? Because I never heard this song. This might be a Neil Lynch original, dude.
If you watched like Beavis and Butthead back in the day, you probably would have saw it. They had that on loop, and the guys would comment on it. But yeah, it was a very trippy video. It was almost like George Clinton and the Parliament Funkadelic. Like had a baby with Elton John's daughter. Like it was very all over the place, but I was digging it.
Well,
that's
fair enough. I'll give you credit. I'll tell you what, you stick to your guns. You like songs that only Neil Lynch likes, which I like a lot about you. I'll be completely honest with you. Number 6, I'm going to go with one that I think a lot of guys will admit to. I mean, this is a band that Jay-Z even likes. And we got 60 seconds left. But before I get to my number 6, for those of you listening live, you can always check us out, tristatesportsguys.com, facebook.com/tristatesportsguys, and on Twitter, you can follow us at tristate_sports. That's about it. If you got stuff you want to email us, tristatesportsguys@gmail.com. I'm going to move on now to my number 6. Like I said, this probably could be a number 10. This isn't that embarrassing, but I really like it, and more than older stuff, but I like Coldplay, Neil. Is that embarrassing that I like Coldplay? It probably is. It's kind of not a very manly group to like, but if Hove likes them, I feel like that kind of gives me a pass, no?
Yeah, I had them, like, on constant – they were constantly playing when I was in college and, like, immediately following college, and then maybe, like, 2005, 2006 started, I realized, okay, maybe I should, like, cut down on this. But
after
years
of going to bed alone.
Yeah. Like, maybe this is not exactly the
lifestyle
that I was hoping for. So I try to avoid Coldplay now because I know, like, maybe it's time that we just went our separate ways, you know. Unless they're paired with Rihanna. They came out with a song with Rihanna that was pretty dope, so I don't know.
I didn't catch that one. But, yeah, it's probably best to make a clean break, and I think I got to make a clean break. I got a Pandora station for Coldplay, so I like them. So I gotta delete that and really just say, you know what, we had a good run, but it's time to part ways. That's a good call by you. Who you got, number six?
Number six, this one, much like the 10th song on my list, it's kind of, the reason why I attach and latch to songs is because they kind of been tied to a memory. So, like, the reason I kind of dig Shaggy and It Wasn't Me is because it's kind of because of a girl, you know, I was kind of seeing at the time. And the same same is true for this, my number six on my slot. It's Hella Good by No Doubt.
I don't know that. I mean, I don't know that very well. Maybe I know the song. I don't know the title of it. Is that a song I know?
Yeah, it was, you know, it's another college-aged track. It was probably, it's from our senior year. And I had a pretty cool night when I first heard that song at the club. It turned into an interesting night. Not the best night, but it was interesting. It was a story. So that's what made my list of number six. It goes, it's like a dun 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 dun.
Oh, I know that song very well. Yeah, that's a good tune.
Yeah. Yeah. The waves keep crashing on me for some reason, yeah.
Yeah, Gwen Stefani will get you with little songs that you're in bear. I mean, in general, she could easily make this list. Because she gets you on songs you're like, eh. I mean, I'm just a girl. Yeah, I'll listen to that. Or that really sad song that they sang when we were in high school, whatever that was. I heard Breaking Up With That Guy in the band. Pretty sad, but everybody likes that song. I don't remember anything about it. You and Me, that song.
Yeah.
Was that a good Gwen Stefani impression? All right.
I honestly thought she was on the line.
What's that?
I thought she was on the line for a second. I thought you dropped out.
She called in. I punched her in. She's on line too. Gwen. All right. Number five. I'm going to tell you a band right now that if you don't like this band, even though I know a lot of people don't and make fun of me for liking them, then you know what? Delete my phone number from your phone because this band is fantastic. They have easily 20 songs that are fantastic. And I'm going to go back to the 80s, possibly even late 70s. I'm going to go with six. I'll take six any day of the week. You put me on a deserted island, and I need to bring a couple albums along with me. I'm taking Pearl Jam. I'll take Tool, and I'm taking Styx, and maybe Wu-Tang. I like Styx. You a Styx fan, Neil?
Yeah, I mean, like, who's got beef with Styx? I don't understand where that's coming from.
Oh, people got beef with Styx. People make fun of me. I got it in my car. I don't own many CDs, but I got a Styx Greatest Hits CD, and, you know, you start listening to me sing Come Sail Away, they kind of make fun of me.
Yeah, and I think for me it was their inclusion in a lot of Adam Sandler movies that kind of sealed the deal for me. It's like, you know, it's just being associated with that kind of laughter. It's kind of hard to shake.
All right, well, who you got number five?
Number five is a song that if you don't remember this one, then we've got some problems. This was a song that collectively as a baseball team at the Johns Hopkins University, was, I don't know, maybe our theme song. I don't know if it was junior year or senior year. It's probably junior year. The title of the song is Around the World, La 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 La. And it's by ATC.
Is that the, I remember Around the World. Around, yeah, that song is great. That's embarrassing that we liked it. But, yeah, that's a great song.
All around the world. Da 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 da. That was
I'll tell you the two songs from our team that year were that song and that I'm blue, I was green, I was nah, but I was deep. Remember that song? That song almost made my list, but I didn't know who sang it. I didn't feel like looking it up. But that's an embarrassing song. Like, well, we used to jam on that on the bus.
Yeah. I mean, we used to take over, if you remember correctly, we used to take over, like, sorority formals. That song would come on. Some jackass from our team would request it from the DJ, and then it was like we then proceeded to domineer and commandeer the dance floor. It was absurd.
And all of our dates would lead with lacrosse players. I remember very well.
Yeah.
The last guys were like, come on, we're the best team in the country. What are you doing with these guys? All right, who do you got? Where are we at? Number four, five? Where are we at?
I did five. You got to give four.
That was, oh, my four, Bruno Mars. I think this guy, every song this guy's ever made is pure gold. And the reason this list started was because I told Tony D I like Bruno Mars, and he told me in my face that's embarrassing. So I was like, we got to do this on the show because, I mean, every song that guy, every time he opens his mouth, it's like it's coming from the angels. That's fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
And he writes all his own songs.
Well, that's key to me. Like, I'm all for singer-songwriters, you know, even if you've got
You know why? Because you are one. Because you know what, Neil? You got that notebook, and you are one. That's why.
Yeah, I stick with my own kind. What can I say?
Birds of a feather, Neil.
Yep.
Who do you got for number four?
Number four is, and I'm not a fan of this woman at all. And I hate to be a hater, and I don't want to talk down upon her. And I know that she's had her issues. I know that she's gone through a lot of stuff. Her brain is basically mush. But I could not get enough of "Toxic" by Britney Spears.
Ew. I can't listen to anything that's a girlfriend. I don't like that lady.
That was just it. I don't know. It just it really hit a nerve with me, and I think it was kind of tied. It was also tied to a girl, and that's probably why. You know, much of like what I do every day, I breathe and I live, I crush, I, you know, whatever, for girls, and I think that's why Britney Spears' "Toxic" made it to the mix there, is because there's a girl that I was kind of seeing, it kind of looked like her, and then the music video is really what did it for me, I think.
What I don't get about your list, and I mean, I'm not criticizing your list, but a lot of your songs have to do with girls that you had a relationship with that didn't work out. To me, I would like there are songs that remind me of girls that in my past, and there was a girl I dated in college who her favorite song was she loved Nelly. And so every Nelly song reminds me of this girl, and I'm just like, you know what, Nelly? I know you're good in the celebrity softball games and all that, but get out of my life, Nelly, because you remind me of this girl. You go the exact opposite. You like it. You like pain.
Yeah, well, because it brings me back to a better time. You know, does that make any sense? Where it's like that song doesn't remind me of the nastier part of our relationship or what you could loosely construe as a relationship, but it reminds me of like that was the moment where I was like, wow, this girl's cool, and like this song is cool, and it all just kind of met, and then it's apparently cemented in my brain forever, and so it's like it cues a memory, a good memory of something positive. I don't know.
Brings you back to a simpler time, Neil. No worries, no tri-state sports guys. You're not trying to ride a pilot. I hear you. I mean, I'm happily married now, so maybe all of these girls I got to block out. I don't know. We're at number three now.
Yeah.
This one's embarrassing. I'm just going to, you know what? I'm going to do a clean. I'm just going to admit it. Phillip Phillips. Guy's fantastic. Guy's a great, great artist. I don't care what you tell me. I don't even know if he won American Idol. Maybe he was a runner-up. I don't remember. But that song he sings, "Make This Place Your Home," that's a catchy tune, Neil. That's a song where you could just listen to it, stare a girl in the eye, and be like, you know what? This is our life. You know what I'm saying? No?
Who is that? Who?
Phillips. It sounds like Dave Matthews. And he sings. He was on American Idol. He had like a heart attack or something weird. He's got a weird backstory. He grew up in a pawn shop, and he sings these songs. He plays guitar. You don't know Phillip Phillips? I'm going to start sending you some Phillip Phillips songs.
I told you
it's embarrassing, and I immediately regretted even putting it on my list because I got a reputation to maintain. But the guy is good. The guy's talented. He deserves more airplay.
How old is this guy?
The guy's probably 25. I don't know. He was on American Idol like 3 years ago, maybe. I don't know. Not long ago. But he was on pretty recently. And the dude, if you were to listen to this song I'm telling you about, you would think it's a Dave Matthews song. It's got that kind of... Not that Dave Matthews is a band I would like to admit that I like either, but that's something that's embarrassing, too. That's for 17-year-old girls. But I like a Dave Matthews song every now and again. It reminds me of high school and all. But Philip Phillips, Neil, look him up. Download some stuff.
I don't know.
Name, but that's his real name, Philip Phillips. He's fantastic.
I know.
That's a true artist.
I feel like I only have room for one band or musician that has their last name is the same as their first, and that's Duran Duran. I don't know that I can make room for another musician like that.
Oh, Jesus. All right, what do you got at number three then, tough guy?
This one is, as if I haven't already ruined my rep. Number three, and I'm sure Tony will appreciate this one, and despite everything that's happened, it comes on, and I just all of a sudden I get kind of very mosh pity. The song Nookie by Limp Bizkit.
You know what, Neil? I'll be honest with you. When I made my list originally, that song made my list. Limp Bizkit made my list. That song and the Faith cover they did. Remember that Faith cover they did?
Yeah.
It was fantastic. It is embarrassing to like anything by Limp Bizkit at this point. I know, but. I'm with you on that. I think that Neil would make fun of both of us, but I'd have your back on Limp Bizkit and Nookie. I like Nookie. I like Kid Rock, too. Go ahead. Judge me. I don't care.
Yeah. Well, see, I'm not embarrassed about Kid Rock as much because I feel like he's more genuine as a person, I think. I don't know.
Yeah, I
look at
Fred Durst is a horrible human being. I get that.
Yeah. Whereas Kid Rock, I mean, that's just kind of like who he is. He's, he's not faking the funk on a nasty dunk. Like he's bringing you what he was, what he is. And, I know that he's kind of gone into a different route now but that's just like his natural evolution. It's not like he said, oh, I need to change my image. He's just like, you know what? This is what I feel now. So that's why I can't get too mad or upset with Kid Rock because I feel like he brought it and it came from a real place that wasn't like a poserish, whereas Limp Bizkit always has been knocked for, being posers or whatever. So,
yeah, I get that.
I don't know.
All right, my number two and one are pretty embarrassing. My number two is Michael Bublé, Neil. I've seen the guy in concert, and he was fantastic. He was awesome. All his songs, every one of his songs. And you know what? And this is going to sound stupid. Every time he sings, it reminds me of Christmas carols. It's got that little, it's like it comes on. You got to listen to it. It's like Christmas carols. Got a little piano. He's got there's like saxophone players and trombones and stuff. I love Michael Bublé. And that's not something you could really tell somebody unless you really trust them. But I like him.
I think you're okay with that one. I think that, if anything, someone's going to be like, who's Michael Bublé? I don't think anyone's going to be like, oh, you're this or that for liking Bublé. I mean, the guy has a hot wife. Am I mistaken? He has a really hot wife.
I don't know. I don't know anything about his life outside of his fantastic music. I will tell you, when we saw him up at Mohegan Sun, my wife and I, and he was very good, but he was like very blue in between songs. He was like mother effing this person and this and that. It was very weird. I didn't think the guy swore. But he had this like little thing. You got to look that up. Google that. Because there's a lot of people, there's like a huge fan base that is now angry at him when they see him live because he's like talking about banging girls and all the crazy stuff on stage, and his audience is all like 60-year-old women. But that kind of turned me off. I had this vision. This guy's like Bing Crosby, and this old school kind of crooner. But I blocked that out because his music is just—it's just delightful. I think. Who's your number two? Is it Beat Michael Bublé?
Yeah, number two and number one are going to be like Tony D might never speak to me again after these two, but this is how bad it is. I don't even know the name of the song. I just know that it's in the first Spider-Man, not the most recent Spider-Man, but the one with Kirsten Dunst and what's his face, James Franco, and the other one.
I've never seen any of the Spider-Man movies, so I don't know what you're talking about. But I'm hopefully
you're
I know
kidding
what
you're me talking. Right now. You're kidding me.
No, I never seen it. Not that I didn't want it. I don't know. I just never caught those, any of those. I never seen any Iron Man movies. I don't watch a lot of.
Oh, man.
I don't know. Are they good? Are they worth me, like, on a date night watching?
I mean, the Spider-Man, maybe, because, I mean, I used to fall asleep to that. Like, when I moved back home after college, I used to fall asleep to that almost every night. Make a nice little screwdriver, nice tall screwdriver, like, nice tall cocky, and then, you know, watch that and fall asleep to it. I mean, it was just like, it was my medicine. It was my little nightcap.
That's like my Big Lebowski. I could fall asleep to Big Lebowski every night, but I take a little bit more pride in that. Let me ask you this before we get going. I mean, we were talking about cocktails. Typically, when you're in studio, you and I have a couple cocktails. Tony D will have a cocktail. I mean, we're getting on the verge of the season of the bourbon and lemonade, which you know is my favorite drink, and I think you grew to love. Are you having a cocktail now during the show or no?
I had a tall, cool glass of H2O. You know, I figured I got to be on point, you know, because, you know, I don't have you by me keeping me in check. You know, even when you are by me, it tends to get a little out of hand. So I want to stay on point. I want to stay focused. And I don't, to be honest, I don't think we have anything good in the fridge. I think we got, like, Prosecco that I got from my aunt. So I don't know.